Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the next hour. Today, less than a week after a controversial ceasefire was brokered in Gaza, we devote the hour to Palestine. Jan Hocken and David Finkel, editor at Against the Current, discuss the deeply flawed ceasefire deal and what it portends for Palestinians. I'll be talking with Dr. Travis Moline about the destruction of the healthcare system in Gaza, while U.S. medicine looks the other way. In between, I'll be reading some passages from Omar El-Akkad's book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This, a book about the deadly complicity of Western liberalism with genocidal war. Our music today is from a Palestinian resistance song titled Haoud, I Will Return, by cellist Yo-Yo Ma in collaboration with vocalists Mashru, Leila, and Narsi. Before we get rolling, I want to remind you that what we talk about on The Old Mole is not something you'll easily find on the commercial airwaves. If you like what you hear, please support your community radio station, KBOO. You can donate by visiting kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. The KBOO community thanks you. I want to begin our show today with a reading from the book called One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This by Portland author Omar El-Akkad. The book was just nominated for the National Book Award and is a scouring analysis of the profound moral failure of Western liberalism and its complicity with the commission of unconscionable horrors abroad in service to empire. Here is El-Akkad on the language employed to obscure imperial violence. The empire is cocooned inside its own fortress of language, a language through the prism of which buildings are never destroyed, but rather spontaneously combust, in which blasts come and go like Chinooks over the mountain, and people are killed, as though to be killed is the only natural and rightful ordering of their existence, as though living was the aberration. And this language might protect the empire's most bloodthirsty fringe, but the fringe has no use for linguistic malpractice. It is instead the middle, the liberal, well-meaning, easily upset middle, that desperately needs the protection this kind of language provides. Because it is the middle of the empire that must look upon this and say, yes, this is tragic, but necessary, because the alternative is barbarism. The alternative to the countless killed and maimed and orphaned and left without home, without school, without hospital, and the screaming from under the rubble and the corpses disposed of by vultures and dogs and the days-old babies left to scream and starve. The alternative is barbarism. I'll be reading more from this important book by Omar El-Akkad. Now I'd like to turn to my recent conversation with Dr. Travis Moline, a Portland-based anesthesiologist and two-time medical volunteer in Gaza, who tells us exactly what a genocidal war looks like on the ground through the lens of emergency medical care. We discuss the wholesale and intentional destruction of healthcare infrastructure, the deliberate detention, torturing, and murder of healthcare workers, and lastly, the outrageous silence of the U.S. medical establishment in the face of what the UN calls medicide in Gaza. This interview was recorded right before the announcement of the ceasefire. By way of introduction to our discussion, I want to share another passage from Omar El-Akkad. There is an impulse in moments like this to appeal to self-interest, to say, these horrors you are allowing to happen, they will come to your doorstep one day, to repeat the famous phrase about who they came for first and who they'll come for next. But this appeal cannot, in matter of fact, work. No, there is no terrible thing coming for you in some distant future, but know that a terrible thing is happening to you now. You are being asked to kill off a part of you that would otherwise scream in opposition to injustice. You are being asked to dismantle the machinery of a functioning conscience. Forget pity. Forget even the dead if you must, but at least fight against the theft of your soul. That was Omar El-Akkad from his book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. Now, here's Dr. Travis Moline. This morning on The Old Mole, I have with me Dr. Travis Moline. Dr. Moline is a local anesthesiologist who has twice volunteered to work in the Gaza Strip, providing emergency medical services to sick and injured Palestinians. Welcome to KBOO and to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Dr. Travis Moline.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Travis, you just came back at the end of August from volunteering in Gaza, and you were working at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Maybe you can start by telling us what your daily work life was like.
So Nasser's the last partially functioning, or one of the last partially functioning hospitals, which is partially functioning is kind of like a misnomer, like the humanitarian safe zone is a misnomer. It is barely functioning in a way that anyone would accept. Staffing wise, because all the hospitals in Gaza have been destroyed, it's kind of a hodgepodge of staff that have worked, you know, at various different hospitals, have been displaced. And so now they're all kind of, you know, kind of thrown into this big mix together. Everyone has ventured into this system from other places. And then from the patient side, you know, being one of the last kind of local hospitals there, it's just completely flooded with people. You know, every bit of square, you know, footage has people, you know, laying on in that space, whether that's a family member of a patient or that's actually, you know, patients themselves. It's extremely occupied. Everything is kind of right on the edge of being completely broken. For example, the operating rooms are on the fourth floor, and there's two elevators to get up there. If that elevator breaks in a way that can't be fixed, it is instantly no longer functioning because there is no more ability to get to an operating room unless you can carry the person up. But yeah, so everything is just partially functioning. There's one CT scanner in that hospital of, I think, five that are left in Gaza when there used to be something like 50 or 60. And that CT scanner is also occasionally breaking. So just extreme crowding, barely functioning equipment, you know, nothing of the replaceable parts have been replaced. So bits of equipment that we might, you know, say are non-reusable here are being reused over and over and over again until they physically fall apart.
What about supplies, particularly medications?
Everything is crisis standards. For example, you know, if your whole arm, leg, and torso are burnt, you're going to need to change those dressings on a regular basis. Just the gauze alone is so limited that we can't do that. We can't change their dressings, but every, at most, every third day. And so when those people do come to the operating room, those wounds are now, they have insects crawling on them, they have maggots in them. Imagine what that does for the potential for healing whatever wound it is. We're using like third line medications. Multiple medications that we're using there are things that I'd only read about in a textbook. So we're using old drugs, both like in their from when they were invented and also old from when they're produced, such that you administer it and it has zero effect. Not only are they short supply, but a lot of them are just not even functioning.
Tell us about the patterns of injuries that you're seeing.
Yeah, this year I mostly dealt with gunshot wounds. That's the vast majority of injuries. There's explosions of all different types that are happening all day long. But a lot of those are demolitions. No one comes of those a lot of the times. Whereas last year, if you heard an explosion, you should run to the ER because they might beat you to the ER if you don't. This year, that's not the case. One of the reasons is location. I was in different hospitals last year that were in the, quote unquote, middle area. So they were kind of far from any gunfighting. So last year was exclusively explosive and burn injuries from, bombs being dropped. This year, almost all of our patients are coming from a, a humanitarian aid site or, people trying to get humanitarian aid. And so they're all gunshot wounds from those areas. We've all heard of the GHF sites, these Gaza humanitarian sites where they're, supposedly distributing food. It's quite a process to physically get to those sites, and then you have to, there's very specific times when they're, they open up, and so people have to gather to get the very limited supplies that they can get there. And basically, what happens is they'll, get into this staging area, start moving towards these aid sites, and the Israeli army will just open fire on them. Can see a million videos on social media of this. Every story that everyone comes to, or comes to the ER has to say is the same thing. We can see them shooting at us. And so they all kind of come from those aid site shootings. This is sometimes hundreds of patients, maybe up to 400,
At a
kind of
time.
at once coming through. And so those are the survivors that are making it in. Because once that shooting starts, you can't just immediately take that person out and bring them to the hospital. The shooting has to stop first for it to be safe for the rescuers to physically get them out. And so if someone's going to die, immediately they probably have, because it may have been hours since they're injured.
The shooting would go on for hours at these sites.
Hard to say. I mean, we can hear shooting, but it's hard to say from that distance exactly, what that shooting is or means. But the, very unique thing, I think, as far as, quote, war injuries is that, this is feels very personal because each individual only has one gunshot wound, which, to me says that there's someone behind the trigger who is aiming, firing, moving to the next target. Not only that, but depending on the day and the time, they might have decided to shoot them all in the head or all in the genital area, and so it kind of will come in these like very clear patterns where, 60 people shot in the head. Or that, the next day you have like 30 gunshot wounds that are, centered right around the, the scrotum. So you have a bunch of scrotal injuries, you have a penile injury, you have two femoral artery injuries, and a few like bladders that got shot, right? And these are all, again, the single gunshot wounds. So this is like very directed, very intentional, to the point where you even see people with gunshot wounds in the tops of their heads, because once the shooting starts, everyone lays flat. And so you see these trajectories that indicate that they were shot while laying flat.
As I understand it, these are mostly men and boys.
Yeah, last year, because explosive injuries kind of just take out whomever is nearby, it was usually half kids, right? Because the population is some 48% kids. So probably half kids, 20 or 30% women, and then, some men. Whereas, yes, this year, because this is all the men going to collect the aid, the vast majority of injuries are men, but certainly gunshot wounds down to, a 2-year-old.
What about the effects of the food blockade? What are you seeing?
Yeah, that was extreme last year in the summer when I was there in July. Every single person could show you pre-war and post-war, and a large amount of weight had been lost by every single person from not having enough food, and right there, Netanyahu's already indicted for war crimes for using food as a weapon back then, right? And so there's been food that has been coming in over the last couple of years, right? But it's enough that people can have a percentage of their required calories. So what kind of had changed this trip is that about 2 or 3 months before I got there, full blockade, no food allowed in, no medical supplies, absolutely nothing going through any crossing anywhere. And people entered this very active phase of starvation, where only if you had privilege and wealth and access and means and hadn't been displaced could you get food. But if you were down on your luck in any way, and 90 to 100% of the population almost is displaced, just getting to like these aid sites, is next to impossible. And then what food did exist in the market, incredibly expensive. We're talking like a $40 tomato. There was a lot of eggplant, oddly, but eggplant has almost 0 calories. So there were things in the market, but nothing that had actual nutritional value. So almost exclusively carbohydrate or empty calorie kind of things that are getting in. And so no surprise that everyone was extremely thin, which made the anatomy of injuries and the, diagnosis of certain things like a lot easier because you could see every little feature of their anatomy. There's just no fat on anyone. You can see a fractured bone just through the skin. You didn't have to have like an X-ray to diagnose a rib fracture. You could just see that it was offset, just looking at their skin. Even to the point where like the medical staff were, for a couple of weeks that were routinely passing out, middle of an operation, walking down the hallway, right? Because this isn't just starvation. Like, they might have URI, upper respiratory infections, right? They're rampant because of the crowding, right? Everyone's getting pneumonias because they're all crammed into this tight humanitarian area. Hepatitis A outbreaks, acute watery diarrhea of different things, right? And then extreme heat, right? It was, July, August, so it's 100 degrees there, and there is no shelter from the sun. And so you add all that on top of not eating. It doesn't take much to push someone into like death from starvation in those conditions.
And potable water.
There's a couple of desalination plants, and there's like sites that people can get water from. And so there's these water trucks that come from like the desalination plants that have like maybe a 500-gallon tank, or it's like on a donkey cart, even that kind of a thing. And they'll kind of drive out every morning to pre-planned positions. And then usually the children will show up to those positions, line up their water buckets, and that'll be like where the family gets their water from the day. Just these are just like open-topped buckets. These are recycled, 2 liter water bottles that have been duct taped together, that kind of thing, right? No easy to carry receptacle. And there might be like 40 or 50 of those lined up, and 40 or 50 kids. And like these are kids, they're shorter than my belly button, like they're young. And they're carrying these water bottles that are about half of their size. And that's who's lining up usually for water and who's in charge of getting it for the day.
I think it was in August that the UN accused Israel of committing meticide. How would you describe that to our listeners?
Well, I mean, I think it's, exactly the same form of any side, scholasticide, right? All the, universities, schools, all that stuff, libraries have been destroyed, right? So meticide is the same. Every single hospital has been bombed. Like there's not one that hasn't been struck, at some point or been completely decommissioned. And even the ones that have been decommissioned and then reopened, you go into those hospitals and like even the equipment inside has been like all intentionally broken, right? You have key components that'll just be cut in half, or you'll have a key computer that is needed to operate a thing and that will have been smashed.
So the IDF will actually enter into the facility and just destroy
Yeah, and there's
whatever they can put their hands on.
yeah, exactly. the individual soldiers are doing this. The Israeli army is doing this by like actively, bombing the hospital, by demanding that these hospitals be, cleared out. The people that are going to run those facilities are being killed. The equipment that is needed to do very simple things like get a blood pressure is not being allowed in. So, I mean, it's essentially not functioning in any way right now that it would be, even 5% of what we would accept.
But isn't it true also that when it comes to healthcare personnel, it's not that they are being caught in the crossfire, it's that they are being intentionally targeted? Did you observe that?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, sometimes they are directly targeted, right? Nasser Hospital, the 15 minutes after I left Nasser, they directly targeted the exact floor that I work on and the exact spots that I had just been saying goodbye to like coworkers and friends at.
Do you think that was a coincidence, or do you think they were kind of waiting for you to leave? Because you were leaving with a group of Western doctors, healthcare providers, is that right?
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation about that. It feels like very intentional, right? It would be a big to-do to kill a Western, person in Gaza, right? That would be more news and bad PR. And so it feels like in order to avoid kind of more international pressure, they, waited to do this strike until, the last Western healthcare workers had stepped out of Nasser. So yeah, anyways, that was, really horrific. It really did feel like it was intentionally timed for as soon as we stepped away. And not only that, but the groups that typically work in that hospital have been slowly no longer allowed to enter that hospital. And so it wasn't just that we had left and they struck, but in the week or two preceding this, an organization might have a few people leave and then the IDF would not allow their next group to come in. And so, the 18 or so doctors and nurses that were working there from international destinations slowly dwindled to one or two.
I understand that you've been asked to go back relatively soon. Do you think you'll be able to get in?
That's the big that's the big question. Every single healthcare worker that goes gets to Amman, Jordan, and then around 8 p.m. in the evening, they're either told no or yes. And about half the doctors who show up at the border are told no, about 12 hours before they would set off to enter. And it's completely arbitrary. No one knows why these people are being denied. Sometimes it's people who have been many times. Sometimes it is people who have never been. Sometimes it's people who are very outspoken on social media. Sometimes it's people who have no social media presence. There's no really clear pattern that I've ever heard of. It's just some people are told no and some aren't in huge proportions. And that proportion seems to have climbed to like a much higher level. Right when I was leaving, it was something like 80% probably were being denied around that time.
And perhaps that's intentional, the lack of pattern to who gets denied, because it would make it more difficult to assemble your teams and.
Everything there does seem intentional. Like it's the most, quote, most sophisticated army in the world, right? And they've been refining their tactics there now for, since 1940s. And so nothing is done without intent.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about what it's been like to be back for you, what kind of reception you're getting from your colleagues, from the institutions you might be working with.
That was a really disappointing thing that I didn't expect, when I returned. I know lots of people were very interested to hear about firsthand experience from someone they know and trust from their community, right? That's valuable. And people, wanted to hear that. People even requested, like, can you come speak to us? And, initially I was excited by that. And what ended up happening, though, is almost all of them get canceled. So, if it's something that I have been approached about and the group have been very excited to do, almost always, around a week to a few days beforehand, the talk or whatever it was would be canceled. And that the story is pretty much always the same. The planning part goes fine, the advertisement goes fine, And then certain people see the advertisement, complain to administration, but invariably, they always side with not being allowed to speak about Gaza within a hospital system. And there's only actually been one hospital system that kind of was like, no, come and speak, and you're free to do whatever you want and say whatever you want. Every other one has either canceled the talks after scheduling them, or have just outright told me no for, a variety of reasons that are they're not like true, and not a good reason to cancel, a valuable speaker.
Share with us some of those excuses they would give.
Well, like the most recent one, and it's fairly, typical, was at a academic hospital on the East Coast, and an invited talk. And 2 days beforehand, they called me and they said, "Hey, we were approached by a couple people in our department who, really were offended that there was going to be a talk about Gaza. The few Arab folks in the group were very interested in hearing it, and there was a variety of other opinions. But in the end, we decided to go, with not having the presentation, just to keep things quiet and calm and cohesive within the department." And that's like kind of a very typical conversation that I am told about. And if I approach someone and say, "Hey, I want to give a presentation at your hospital. Would you be interested?" They'll say things like, no, it doesn't meet our educational objectives," or "There's nothing to learn from your experience." Or on occasion they'll say, "Oh, we'd really like to, have you at a venue outside of the hospital." Right, just a nice, polite way of saying no.
Do you think it has anything to do with the donor base for those hospitals?
I do wonder. I mean, I think a lot of the choices, it feels like, come from a departmental level, like the head of a department. So that's usually where it comes from, and so where their pressure is coming from, I don't know if it's just this cohesion and their inherent bias together, or if the hospital system has said, "Hey, we don't want us to be in the news because we don't want our financing, or our government support or whatever it is to be in jeopardy."
I've read about, I think, six physicians who have been fired nationwide for posting pro-Palestinian views on social media or making comments or whatever. And interestingly enough, when I look at those cases, one of them was a white guy, and all the others were either women, people of color, or both. Are you concerned about that kind of thing happening to you?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, like I said, no hospital system has ever come out against this genocide, right? No hospital has called for a ceasefire in Palestine, right? They only call for these things for Ukraine and Sudan and other places, no problems. But specifically when it comes to Gaza, like no hospital system has said we, are against genocide. We are pro ceasefire. We are in favor of humanitarian aid. Like from that level, there is absolutely no support, and even a very intentional turning away from a very obvious medical issue.
Yeah, I know the
And
AMA declined to call for a ceasefire and put out a very weak statement about maintaining medical neutrality.
yeah, I don't know what the benefit of medical neutrality is when there's a, like a documented, obvious genocide that's been called a genocide by everyone who has the authority to do so.
It's very easy to, and I think this happens pretty much all the time, to portray Palestinians as being victims, and certainly they are that. But you've spent now a total of what, 4 months living and working with Palestinians, and I'm curious about your perspective on how they survive, how they resist.
I mean, everyone is just forced to find their limit. I mean, everyone's just been pushed so far, right? So we're finding like the limits of what humans can take in this circumstance, right? We're finding the limits of what a healthcare worker can do during an active famine, right? Like we're seeing healthcare workers that are physically passing out during surgery. There's a resiliency that we shouldn't have to find the edges of, and we're finding the edges of resiliency there. I guess I feel a little funny about the word resiliency a lot of times when I'm talking about this because it's a
I
forced
see.
resiliency, if that makes sense. Like no one would choose the position that they're in, but everyone's just kind of forced into it.
Well, we have to wrap up, and I'm very grateful for your spending this time with me to talk about what's going on in Gaza in some detail. There are no journalists there anymore, so foreign doctors are really starting to take on that burden of reporting. Do you have anything else that you want to talk about or say about your experiences there?
I think one thing that I hope, but never seems, to materialize is that people would listen to, someone from a local community, that they trust, right? Because there's no trust in the media right now. Like, there are people that are saying everything's faked and the starvation is faked over there. And, so I guess, for what it's worth, here's someone, from your community who's, spent 4 months there. And I can tell you that like everything that you see in those reels is in those on Instagram or, wherever you're getting your media from, like that's all real.
Thanks a lot, Travis, and we wish you the best of luck in getting back into Gaza to do this really important work. I hope maybe have you back on the show when you come back again.
I'd love to come back and tell you about the next experience, for sure. Thanks for having me on.
That was a musical clip from Haoud, I Will Return by Yo-Yo Ma with vocalists Mashrou, Layla, and Narsi. Before that, you heard from medical volunteer in Gaza and local physician Dr. Travis Malim. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. On October 30, Dr. Malim will be the featured speaker at a local event called Targeting Doctors in Gaza, Breaking the Silence, at the First Unitarian Church from 7 to 9 p.m. The event includes a vigil for murdered Palestinian healthcare workers and a short film by Jan Hocken called Samud, A Doctor's Report on Genocide and Survival in Gaza. Jan's film, Samud, features not only Dr. Malim, but also Omar El-Akkad, with his perspective on the war in Gaza. We will link to a full description of the event on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm. Now here is another reflection from El-Akkad's book about the nature of imperial violence. Maybe the real fear is that when one begins to consider the root systems of small-scale, sometimes state-supported, but often stateless evil, there's an obligation to apply the same rigor to the large-scale machinery of imperial evil. And in doing so, one might find that what drives and absolves the state of so much evil isn't the fear that not doing so will allow some terrorist to destroy the fabric of free society, but rather that the evil itself is necessary to the system it protects, that in the end there is no international rules-based order, no universal human rights, no equal justice for all, simply fleeting arrangements of convenience in which any amount of human collateral is deemed acceptable so long as it works in the empire's interest. Now we turn to Jan Hocken speaking with David Finkel about how this ceasefire differs from earlier ceasefires in Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza. How to understand the U.S. and geopolitical implications of this peace plan, and how the global Palestinian movement must continue to take actions and mobilize. David Finkel is an editor at the Journal Against the Current and a Middle East scholar.
Welcome back to KABU and the Old Mole Variety Hour, David Finkel.
Good to be here.
Well, as an editor of the Journal Against the Current, you have covered Palestine for years, as well as the genocide in Gaza since October 7th, and the global Palestine solidarity movement. There are a range of assessments now of the 20-point peace plan that Trump brokered with Netanyahu, and what this plan portends for the people of Gaza and for the global Palestine solidarity movement. Well, with phase one underway, what is your assessment of the ceasefire and how this may be different from previous ceasefires?
Well, I look at it from two angles. As a ceasefire agreement, it's necessary, although things are rapidly developing and there are going to be all kinds of provocations. But I believe it will hold, and I believe the reason that it will hold up, although I can't pretend to know about Hamas's intentions. I'm quite sure that Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government would like to violate it and renew the war, but they are not really able to. At this point, the Trump administration, for its own reasons, as well as Trump's vanity, will not allow it. The regional Arab states will not allow it. And I believe actually that a resumption of the invasion of Gaza by the Israeli army would risk the collapse of the Israeli army and the mass desertion of reservists who are, you know, totally sick and fed up with this whole thing. So I believe that the ceasefire in roughly its present form is likely to hold. I think that Israel will attempt to continue as much as it can to block some of the food and medical supplies from getting in. They'll delay those things on the pretext that the bodies of two dozen or so deceased hostages haven't been released, probably because Hamas can't easily locate where they are. But it will hold. It's a good thing as far as it goes. It's a good thing that 2,000 Palestinian prisoners are released, although I believe something like 12,000 Palestinians remain in Israeli prisons. It's a good thing that the Israeli hostages are home. At the same time, it's absolutely enraging to consider that this exact deal could have been reached at least 18 months ago, in March 2024, or even earlier in January 2024. But the Biden administration and Antony Blinken, his wretched Secretary of State, would not impose it on Israel at that time, as it should have done. So it's both a matter of relief and outrage.
What's your assessment of Israel having pulled back from Gaza's major cities, but to a yellow line that means it still occupies about 53% of the territory? And Netanyahu, in a statement last week, claimed even as this ceasefire was underway, we are encircling Hamas from all directions. So they have pulled back. There's a ceasefire, but they're still proclaiming their control over the Gaza Strip.
I don't think that Netanyahu actually intends to relinquish control of the Gaza Strip ever, except to the extent that he's forced to.
Yeah, that remains among the many points in the plan yet to be operationalized. You mentioned the difference between Biden and Trump. This is clearly the revisiting of a ceasefire is a product of tremendous shift, even among evangelicals in the U.S. in their positions on Israel and the global Palestine solidarity movement. But is it also that Trump isn't a Zionist in the same way Biden was? He's more of a real estate guy who is approaching this in a different way. and a different conception of the US as an empire and a broker of deals.
Sure. Well, I think there are two things to be said about what happened with Trump, particularly after Netanyahu bombed the Hamas negotiating team, trying to assassinate Hamas's negotiators in Doha. And there were two things about that. First of all, up until recently, what Israel has done, as atrocious and genocidal as it is, has been seen by U.S. imperial geopolitical thinkers as a great benefit. That is, Hamas and Hezbollah have been militarily neutered. They exist as political forces, but they are militarily neutered. The pro-Iranian axis of resistance has basically been shattered. Iran itself has been greatly weakened, and this strengthened the hand of the United States in the region. But Israel was going beyond the point where it was beneficial to the U.S. overlord. That is, Israel does not intend to allow the new Syrian government to stay intact or to preside over a unified democratic country. They're carving up southern Syria. They're bombing Lebanon every day. And then when Netanyahu bombed Qatar, Qatar is a big strategic U.S. ally, even though a lot of the neoconservatives don't like it, because it hosts the big U.S. military base. This was really beyond what the Americans would accept. And also something else. There's another factor that intersects with this. The arrangements with Qatar and the other Gulf kingdoms are going to enable the Trump family, the Kushner family, the Witkoff family, and other crony capitalists to get even wealthier, to get super rich from all kinds of real estate and weapons and corrupt deals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so Trump was not about to let Netanyahu mess that up for him. So when Netanyahu visited the White House shortly after that, Trump forced him on live on camera to get on the phone with the Prime Minister of Qatar and read word for word a statement that the White House and Qatar had dictated to him. So I think that partly was a trigger. And it's partly geopolitics and it's partly Trump's greed.
Yeah, there's been much coverage of the absurd and perverse plan that Trump rolled out about Gaza of the Riviera of the Middle West of the Middle East sometime back, and he did roll back on that. But there's another real estate vision that is still very much in play here with this so-called peace plan. Can you say a little more about that? Because it does seem to point to what the U.S. interests are in this.
Well, what the U.S. envisions is a partnership between Israel and allied Arab Gulf kingdoms. As a matter of fact, Saudi Arabia is already unofficially, but quite clearly, an Israeli ally. But Israel needs to be kept in check enough so that that alliance can be formalized. And then all kinds of commercial and military and real estate deals can be made that will further enrich the Trumps, the Kushners, the Witkoffs, and others, including Tony Blair. But the deal, the so-called 20-point peace plan, I said, as a ceasefire, it's essential and important. That's a good thing. As a peace deal, it's a disaster. It will never work. All right.
Okay, I was going to say
Yeah.
many critics have described the plan as neocolonial, but you have a different way of framing the relationship between the oppressor and the oppressed here.
Well, yeah, neocolonial means that the relations of domination are preserved in collaboration with local elites from the colonized people. This deal is, I would call, paleocolonial. That is, no Palestinian representation was consulted about it in any way whatsoever. The intention the U.S. intention clearly is to normalize the colonial apartheid occupation. Nothing is being done to redress the violent ethnic cleansing which is happening in the West Bank. And it's a formula for another generation of misery and violence. And the terms of the 20 points or however many points there are so vague that they don't really even amount to very much. Meanwhile, the immediate issue continues to be the massive destruction of Gaza, the bodies under the rubble, the starvation, the sheer physical annihilation, the fact that the medical facilities, the hospitals, the clinics, everything has been blown up. And this was by the criteria of the United Nations Convention on the Prevention of Genocide, which anybody can look up. Look up United Nations Convention on the Prevention of Genocide, Article 2, and then there's points 1 through 5. You will see that points 1 through 4 correspond exactly to what Israel has done in Gaza. And this must not be forgotten. And forgetting for the moment about Trump's original, Mar-a-Gaza fantasy, the United States, which enabled this destruction, has not committed itself to paying for it.
So let's turn to the peace plan exposing its illusions and pretenses for the global Justice for Palestine movement. Can you speak to that? Because there are some victories. I mean, some of what has come about and the pressure on the Trump regime and the various actors who have to address their own public support for the Palestinian cause. I mean, there are pressures from that direction operating, as well as the reaches of the empire and real estate deals. What's your assessment of where we are now with the global Justice for Palestine movement?
Sure. Well, global public opinion, including the United States, has shifted dramatically in favor of Palestine. And that's the only direction from which any kind of pressure for any measure of justice and actual peace can come. We should never expect imperial powers to create anything resembling peace with justice. So the change in public opinion is critical. I'm afraid that large parts of our American media, particularly corporate media, are going to want to move on, celebrate the return of the hostages, and forget about as much as possible what's actually been done to Gaza. And this cannot be allowed to be forgotten. I think that the BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions movement has to be continued, and the issue of Palestine needs to be along with so many other things like immigration and environmental justice and so on. Palestine needs to be continued to be upfront in those actions. It used to be that Palestine was marginalized and sort of shunted aside by the peace movement. And it's a big gain that that's no longer the case, that Palestine is now a central issue and it needs to continue to be.
And of itself, a symptom and a cause of the ongoing fight against empire and colonialism.
It is. The reality, however, is very sobering. Okay. Palestine has no strategic allies among the ruling classes and ruling elites of the world, including the Arab world. The populations of Arab and Muslim countries are favorable and very sympathetic to the Palestinians. The ruling elites and ruling classes are not. So this will continue to be a long, hard struggle. The intention of the Israeli government in this war was to basically destroy Palestinian society in the Palestinian homeland. And it envisioned the mass removal of Palestinians, of the Palestinian population from Gaza and the West Bank. Conditions in the world make that impossible. It is impossible for any other country to collude in this massive ethnic cleansing and genocidal project. However, conditions are going to be very, very difficult and even desperate.
Can you expand on that point? Why are you saying it's difficult for other countries to continue to collude in the genocide?
Because their populations won't accept it, and because no country in the Middle East or elsewhere can afford to say, "Oh yeah, we'll allow 2, 3, 4, 5 million Palestinians to be dumped here," because it would create so much chaos and instability. So that's the limiting factor.
I think the inspiring insistence on Gazans to refuse to submit, refuse to leave. I mean, even under these conditions that are almost unthinkable, the starvation, pressure, confinement, massive bombing and killing, there is relatively little chaos. I mean, there's some Israeli-supported gangs and militia, but I've been struck by just the determination and the level of people, you know, rescuing their families, carrying them into healthcare centers, that, and a certain kind of discipline under fire and refusal to submit. The term "samud" is used throughout this period of resistance to capture that idea of steadfastness under pressures of enormous inequality and violence.
Yes, it is determination. It's also desperation. And, you know, until the Palestinian people in the West, in Gaza and in the West Bank, and all throughout the Palestinian diaspora, until they are able to freely express their views in an open and free election, where they can deliver their own verdict on their leadership and their aspiring leadership. I don't really want to draw a lot of premature conclusions. Yes, it's steadfastness. It's also a desperate struggle for survival at one and the same time.
Yes.
I admire it, but I don't romanticize it.
Yeah. And there is that potential to celebrate the resilience of these people, and why should people have to display such superhuman resilience? Yeah. So in closing, where would you direct listeners to continue to follow, to insist on the critical tasks of the Global Palestine Movement?
Right. Global Palestine is a term developed by the Israeli historian Ilan Pape. And I really recommend looking at Ilan Pape's books. They're fantastic. But for a couple of sources, there's lots of them, but I particularly recommend two. Number one, many of your listeners are undoubtedly familiar with the daily Democracy Now! Broadcast, which does a lot of excellent coverage. I'd also suggest an online publication from Israel called plus972.org. They have terrific coverage, very enlightening, thought-provoking, and they need subscriber support. So I really recommend them as well. You can go to the Against the Current website, againstthecurrent.org, where we publish a lot of material on Palestine and other things too, of course.
And your zine, web zine.
The webzine is at www.solidarity-us.org, solidarity-us.org.
And of course, you can support us here on KBOO Community Radio and the Olmo Variety Hour, where we'll continue to report on the tragedy, the horrors of the genocide, but also the ongoing resistance and ways we can all support global Palestine. So thank you so much, David Finkel, for joining me on the Olmo Variety Hour today.
Thanks so much, and a salute to everybody out there who is confronting ICE.
That's right. These are different chapters in the same book.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you, David. Keep up the good work.
That was Jan Hocken speaking with David Finkel about the ceasefire in Gaza. I'd like to conclude our show with one final passage. From One Day, Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This, nominee for the National Book Award by Portlander Omar El-Akkad. In this paragraph, El-Akkad challenges us to consider the nature of normalcy when that normalcy obligates us to close our eyes and ears to the evil perpetrated in our name. A chasm has developed these last few months, one of many, but one that cannot be bridged. On one side is a portion of society that fears nothing more than the discontinuation of normalcy, that believes, regardless of what horror each new day brings, what matters most is to live as one had lived before, answering emails and meeting deadlines and maintaining productivity. On the other is that portion which, having witnessed the horror, is simply unable to continue as before. How does one live hearing the screams, bearing witness to the bodies? How does anything else matter? The fear of some comfort disappearing collides with a different fear, a fear that any society whose functioning demands one ignore carnage of this scale for the sake of artificial normalcy is by definition sociopathic. That's a wrap for our show today. I want to thank Jan Hocken for her contribution and a special thanks to our guests, Dr. Travis Moline and David Finkel. A shout out to the staff at KBOO who toil behind the scenes to keep community radio alive in Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Please join us on October 30, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church for an event called Targeting Doctors in Gaza, Breaking the Silence. The event includes a vigil for murdered Palestinian healthcare workers, a short film by Jan Hocken called Samud, a doctor's report on genocide and survival in Gaza, and a firsthand account of conditions in Gaza with Dr. Travis Moline. Further details can be found on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm. To close, here's a final soundbite from Haoud, I Will Return, featuring Yo-Yo Ma, Mashru, Layla, and Narsi. Thanks for listening.